The crowd in the saloon was noisy and out of all proportion for barely past noon on a weekday. Monahan leaned in toward Sweeney.
I said it weren't nothing.
He hadn't yet realized it had been his and Alf's little dog and pony show that had provided an excuse for the townsman.
Just creased the hair over his croup is all.
Monahan lifted his mug and took another deep drink. Sweeney nodded his head, indicating he'd understood. Tired of trying to have a conversation over the noise of the saloon, Sweeney pointed to his ear and then to the door. Monahan nodded back. They both stood up and walked to the front door. Once outside, Monahan leaned up against a porch post. Sweeney followed him out, followed by the Blue Myrtle dog.
Too noisy in there to converse. What I was going to tell you is I'm going back to the hotel. If you're right about Dev being around, I want to make myself scarce.
And is he tough to find?
Exactly. If he's going to kill us, I'm going to make this target one he has to work for.
That lawman say anything about a reward?
Said he'd talk about it once he got time to interview you. I guess that means he wants to ask you some questions. Busy little son of a gun, ain't he?
That he is. You know, I'd swear there was something I was aching to tell you, except I'll be damned if I can remember what it was.
Sweeney shrugged.
Was it about the little gal, maybe?
Julia? By the way, I hate like sin to be giving her credit for it, but she was the one that sent Blue charging up the street after that gunman.
How the hell she do that? I mean, she ain't known that dog more than a couple days.
I reckon it was long enough. She just got down on one knee and whispered something to him and then pointed up the street and bang! That hound was off and running.
Well, I'll be. Hey, Butch, you check him over? I mean, Alf didn't get off a lucky shot, did he? Don't want nobody shooting my dog full of holes.
Nah, he's fine. Ain't got a scratch on him.
Are you certain?
Go over him yourself. Ain't no skin off my nose. You checked Chili when you were across the street, right?
Looked fine. Go over him yourself.
Sure, sounds good.
Monahan made his way down to the hotel with Blue happily trailing at his heels. By supper time, Dev Baylor had given up guarding the jail, which remained congested with curiosity seekers and lawmen alike, and abandoned his alley for a perch at the Iron Creek Cafe, where he was digging his fork and knife into a thick, freshly butchered steak. Well, according to the waiter, it was fresh. It couldn't have been proven by Dev, although considering all that had gone on in town, he wouldn't have put it past him to butcher every edible critter in outright decadent celebration. To tell the truth, he was more than a little jealous. To think that Alf's capture was the call for all the jubilation. It made his teeth hurt, that was what. If Alf had been handy, he would have backhanded him just for trying to make himself look bigger. And don't forget failing to kill Monahan. That was the most stupid thing of all. He sawed at his steak and poked another bloody bite into his mouth. It seemed he was chewing a lot more than normal, and he couldn't for the life of him find the salt. A hand clasped his upper arm. He twisted toward it.
You'd be a stranger in these parts?
Once Dev's eyes followed the hand to the arm to the shoulder of the man, he made himself smile.
You shouldn't go around like that, grabbing fellers out of the blue, Sheriff. And, yeah, I rode into your fair city this afternoon.
He leaned toward Sheriff Carmichael and propped an elbow on the table. He swept a hand toward the jostling crowd.
What the hell's got into these folks? Or is Iron Creek just a naturally happy town?
The sheriff let go of his arm.
You ever heard of the Baylor boys?
No, I've never known anyone by that name. As you said, I'm a stranger to these parts. My name is Richard Blessing. I'm in the wool business, selling it, not raising it. I'm on my way to California to close a few deals. What have these Baylor boys done?
The sheriff filled him in on the recent doings in town, by which he was properly amazed, of course. So properly that before the sheriff moved on to quiz a lone man at a table in the back, he shook Dev's hand.
Well, welcome to our town, Mr. Blessing. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Sheriff. Glad to be here. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure's mine.
Noontime had come and gone, and nap time along with it, so Monahan went on down the hall to Julia's room. She came to the door right off, but her eyes were tear-stained. Once she'd seen who it was, she turned her face away from him.
You eat yet?
She shook her head, but kept it turned away.
Well, let's you and me go see if they have anything edible up to the cafe.
Nodding stiffly, she followed him from the room. They were outside the front door before she broke down, out of the blue, it seemed to Monahan, and had to sit on the steps with her face in her hands.
All right, Miss Julia. You best be telling me what's bothering you.
She did. It wasn't anything he wanted to hear, or even think about, for that matter. But once she opened up, getting her to stop was like trying to close the floodgates. She didn't want to go back home, and he could well see why. The fact was, he'd like to get his hands around that uncle's neck for about 5 minutes, that was what. Well, maybe not, especially when Julia described him as a big fella, a mountain of a man, muscled up like a bull and twice as mean. Monahan wasn't young anymore and doubted he'd survive an encounter. But he decided that Julia wasn't staying with a man like that. Hell, he had a hard time even thinking of him as a man.
This, uncle of yours, whereabouts does he live? I mean, how likely is he to be in town?
He only lives about a mile up the creek. I'm sorry. I never told anybody before.
There.
As he rocked her, it occurred to him he might have been a good father, had he stayed put long enough to sink down stable roots, and had he taken up with a good woman. He had, of course. He had taken up with Kathleen.
Well, we best not go parading you out in the street, then. What do you say you go back to your room? I'll bring you a sandwich.
But what about tomorrow?
And we'll figure that out when we get there. But don't you fret none. We ain't gonna leave you nowhere near that nasty old skunk. Not for peaches nor pearls. Now go on back inside. Don't worry. I'll see to you.
A short time later, he was back in Julia's room and watching her eat her sandwich. By the time he headed for the door, she was fed and happy, nearly purring like a baby kitten.
I reckon Butcher or I'll stop by with some dinner for you around 7. Think you can hold out till then?
Mr. Monahan? They used to have some real good rhubarb pie at the cafe. If you wouldn't mind, could you maybe bring me?
Sure. If they got any, it's yours. And Mr. Monahan was my daddy. You call me Dooley.
By the time he reached the lobby, Sweeney was walking down the stairs. He raised a hand.
You going to Sheriff Carmichael's office, Dooley?
Why?
Seems to me like he was looking for you. I mean, you were involved in the arrest of Alf Baylor this morning. Or have I got the wrong Dooley Monahan?
Why are you asking? You found you got some time to kill?
I thought I might walk up there with you, if you don't mind. I'd like to have a look at this killer who's been dogging us all over the territory.
Monahan walked toward the front door.
No skin off my hide.
By supper time, Monahan and Sweeney had been at Carmichael's mercy for several hours. The sheriff's office, also the jail and the courthouse, was cramped and only half-heartedly tended to. Two cells sat side by side not 10 feet from the back wall and less than 5 feet from the sheriff's desk. On the opposite wall stood a spare chair and the requisite row of filing cabinets, topped by a teetering stack of unfiled paperwork and a jumbled pile of hardware so mixed Monahan couldn't tell what it was or what it used to be. Two stacks of old newspapers swayed on the floor at the end of the file cabinets, and a door behind the desk led, according to the crooked sign, to the courthouse. He'd got a good close-up look at Alf for the first time, and allowed that he'd never seen him before, only heard of his handiwork, and showed the tattered voucher for his brother. Pulling his wallet out again, he handed over the precious clipping to Sweeney. He filed it away in his pocket without looking at it. Alf didn't seem like such a bloodthirsty killer when he was behind bars. He was so thin and lanky, he fairly rattled in his clothes, although the age and condition of his frayed and grimy trousers and shirt indicated his physical condition was nothing new. His visage revealed nothing more. His dull eyes were cloudy, which might explain his poor marksmanship. Or he could very simply be a bad shot. Monahan didn't much care. He plain took a dislike to the man right off the bat, would have disliked him even if he hadn't been in Alf's sights earlier in the day. It was just the general principle of the thing. As for his opinion of Sheriff Carmichael, well, that hadn't changed much since the night out at Blue's place. He still found the sheriff too sold on himself to be of any interest, let alone even a feigned friendship. Sweeney was of a similar opinion. At least, he was no more polite than he had to be, and spent most of the interview slumped in the spare chair, staring at the floor or out at the street. When the sheriff finally sent them on their way, Monahan was sure of two things. First, Alf would be free of Carmichael's custody within 24 hours. He could tell by Alf's confident manner and the state of the jail itself. Even if Dev Baylor turned out to be a 70-year-old fat widower with roomy joints and cataracts covering his eyes like peony petals, he could break Alf out of jail between drags on his smoke and never lose a flake of ash. Unless he was a jackass as dumb as Alf. Monahan didn't think that was possible. God could play nasty, which was true enough, but he wasn't outright cruel. Second, Carmichael didn't seem to give a whit about securing his prisoner. The deputy who had been on guard at the door when they arrived had long since gone off duty, and it didn't look much like the sheriff was expecting anybody to take his place. In fact, when Carmichael followed them out, he made a show of locking the jailhouse door behind him, as if that was that. Monahan was pretty certain a kid could have picked that door lock open with a half-sharp stick. He and Sweeney wandered up the street a bit to let the Arizona air blow the jail stench from their clothes, and then they turned around and walked back down the street to the cafe.
Here or the saloon?
Here, I reckon. Promised the girl I'd bring her some cafe supper.
Sweeney nodded, and Monahan opened the door and stepped in.
Whoa!
Inside, Sheriff Milton J. Carmichael stepped back from the opening door, narrowly avoiding a collision with Monahan.
Ain't seen you fellas for a few minutes. I was just leaving.
He gave a wave to the waiter at the front counter.
Crowd got thin here all of a sudden. Hope it wasn't me what caused it.
Nah, no, it wasn't you, Milt. Crowd thins out right about 6 on weekdays.
Sweeney gave a tip to the brim of his hat.
Be seeing you, Sheriff.
Yeah, later.
They moved toward the rear of the establishment. Dooley slid into the first empty chair they came to. Sweeney seated himself across the table and picked up a menu.
I hear right you taking supper back for that girl?
Unless you'd rather let her starve.
Well, I'd rather let her take her meals at her own place.
Ain't like you're paying for them.
Sweeney put down his menu.
This ain't got nothing to do with money. It's got to do with...
Can I take your order, gents?
The waiter stood next to their table, pencil poised over his pad of paper.
Beef stew and biscuits.
I'll take one chicken dinner to eat here, another to take with me.
Oh, you must be hungry. Yeah, coming right up, gents.
When they had the table to themselves again, Monahan turned back to Sweeney.
Eat up. You can tell me what you know about Julia, and I'll explain what I know when we get back to the hotel.
Monahan and Sweeney exited the cafe, well satisfied, and bearing a paper-wrapped dinner for Julia. Sweeney stopped for a moment outside on the boardwalk. Curious, Monahan stopped too, following Sweeney's line of vision. He found himself staring straight up the street at the jailhouse. He couldn't see too clearly, but it looked to him like there was movement around the front door.
What'd you see?
Don't know. Could have sworn that front door closed. I mean, it was wide open.
Yeah, maybe it was the sheriff. You going back to the office? Say anything to you?
Yeah, fat chance. Of him going back to work or telling me about it, I mean.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Thinking you're probably wanting to get Julia supper to her before she perishes or it goes cold or both, aren't you?
Yeah, sure.
Turning, he hurried back down the boardwalk. Sweeney ran after him. After dropping off Julia's supper, they went back to their hotel room. Sweeney went straight to the chair by the window, sat down, and stuck out his legs.
All right, what the hell's going on?
Monahan scratched at his head.
Come on, Dooley, what's up with that gal and with what we just saw over at the sheriff's office and also with
one damn thing at a time.
Monahan sat down on the side of his bed.
First, Miss Julia. About Miss Julia. She don't want to go home. The fact is, she ain't got no home to go to. No people, either. Her uncle ain't a real uncle at all. He's a no account that took her in after her folks died of the smallpox. She was 8 then, and moved her out here. He waited till he thought she got old enough, started with her monthlies, and then he set into raping her every chance he got.
Jehoshaphat.
That's why she was talking so tough when we found her. You know that stuff about making a living on her back just to get away and,
I didn't think she knew what she was talking about, but I didn't know all...
Since she was just turned 11, and she's 13 now. 2 years is a big chunk of a little kid's life.
If anybody's. So we're taking her along then?
Can't rightly leave her here.
Nope. We have to get her a horse.
I know. Reckon we can get one from Tommy over at the livery.
Who?
Tommy Hawk, the Indian kid they got working over at the stables.
Tommy Hawk? You gotta be kidding me. Did his parents name him that?
maybe it's a nickname, but that's how he introduced himself.
Well, hell. Maybe he should just up and go with us, too.
Mayhap he should. He'll have to get a move on if he wants to leave with us, though.
What do you mean?
That thing up at the sheriff's office. I'm willing to bet we was witnesses to a jailbreak.
Oh, damn.
Just before dawn, the two men and the young girl finally set out for the livery. Sweeney saddled the horses, while Monahan looked over the rest of the stock and made a mental list of those he found unacceptable and those with promise. Tommy showed up about the time the first fingers of morning light appeared in the east, and Monahan quickly made a good deal on a bay gelding with some used tack. Julia had been hoping for a wilder-colored, flashier horse, but accepted the bay gratefully. When Tommy admitted he didn't know the horse's name, she christened it Parnell, for reasons known only to her. To Monahan's mind, it didn't much matter what name you gave a horse, so long as the horse knew it and it wasn't silly. Of course, he had ridden a washed-out Palomino gelding called Blondie for a while. It wasn't the best name, but then it wasn't his horse. It was only a loner after his old horse, Chesapeake, got gored by a Mexican fighting bull and died over in Alamogordo. He'd been against bullfighting before that. He thought it was pointless and not a sport at all. But afterward, he retracted his former opinion. Those bulls were mean through and through and deserved whatever life or death handed them. Shortly after 8, they stopped for breakfast, and Monahan announced over his coffee cup where they were going. He'd given them no clue earlier. They'd been drifting generally southward with no destination that either Sweeney or Julia knew of.
Got a friend down here. Lives on the old Mormon trail. Got a ranch right smack dab in the middle of nowhere.
Mormons in Arizona?
Yeah. A battalion of Mormon volunteers marched through here to fight the Mexicans about 25 years ago. I figure we can bide there for a spell. At least until the heat over taking Julia dies down.
Taking me? You didn't take me. Nobody takes me.
Yeah, sorry. Poor choice of words.
Apology accepted.
All right, then. Gather up your stuff. We're pulling out.
Come mid-afternoon, they had turned toward the east when they hit the first signs of the old Mormon trail. It was marked on both sides by broken glass that sparkled for miles before and behind them. By abandoned Conestoga wagons with the weathered remains of broken axles plunging upward through the wagon beds. By big, heavy objects like pianos or shiffer robes, discarded after being hauled for miles. And by graves marked with everything from granite slabs to wooden crosses tied together with rotting cloth to simple cairns of rocks. And except for the low hills that marked the distant horizons, there was nothing around but desert. Sweeney and Julia gawked at first, then became jaded to the sights as the afternoon wore on and the temperatures rose. Neither was accustomed to the heat on the flats, and several times Monahan seriously considered calling a halt until the evening. But that all changed when he saw the first signs of Hoskins' farm. He spied cattle here and there, scattered in the distance ahead. They roamed aimlessly or rooted through the low scrub, looking for anything they might have missed earlier. As they drew nearer, more and more stray memories floated through Dooley's mind like so many wandering balloons. Some floated within his reach, like the face of buckshot Bob Hoskins' daughter Maggie and her little pup Daisy June. The inside of the Hoskins' home, the warm kitchen in particular, and the roast beef buckshot Bob's wife May had served on his last visit. And the stock pond buckshot Bob was just beginning to dig out back behind the barns. It wasn't much longer before he saw the house and the barns dimly outlined in the distance. He felt his heart flood with joy that he remembered them. Without realizing it, he nudged General Grant into a trot. The trio gained the Hoskins spread within a half hour. They rode into the yard. As they dismounted, the house door opened and people poured out. Monahan recognized May and Buckshot Bob right away. He didn't recognize Maggie, who at 15 was almost grown, or her younger brother Robbie, although he was the spitting image of his father. Their dog, Daisy June, having long left puppyhood behind, followed in their wake, wagging her little stub of a tail behind her and greeting Blue in the time-honored style of dogs the world over.
Oh, Dooley, is it really you?
May threw her arms around him.
Oh, it's been over 8 years, hasn't it, Bob?
9, mayhap 10.
Bob's wide grin was framed by a close-cropped goatee and graying mustache. Buckshot Bob Hoskins had met up with Monahan long ago, back when Dooley was trying to retrieve his memories of Iowa and his folks, Missouri and Monty's Raiders, and Kathleen.
Well, no matter what, it's been too long. You're all welcome. I hope you can stay with us a while.
After the work was done, for two long evenings on the front porch, consuming too many cigarettes and countless pots of coffee, Buckshot Bob and Monahan had relived their experiences together through the years up to just prior to the Civil War. Sweeney had sat with them and listened. Now, on a Sunday afternoon, the two old friends sat on the porch steps, a half-gone pitcher of lemonade between them. Sweeney sat behind them in a rocker on the porch so as not to intrude, the slow rhythm of his rocking reminding Monahan of home and Iowa, of his ma rocking softly while she sewed and mended in the main room when he was just a little tyke and had been put down for a nap. The sound soothed him as he listened to Bob tell the tale of Dooley's wandering during the years before the war. He remembered most of it with Buckshot Bob there to provoke his mind, but as Bob talked, part of it sounded like something out of a storybook, outlandish tales some writer had made up, featuring a hero, or maybe a villain, who happened to carry the name of Dooley Monahan. He was torn about that part. He leaned back, resting his spine against the center step.
My goodness. That's quite a story there, Bob. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to remember it and to say it all out for me.
Bob poured them each a fresh glass of lemonade, then turned and offered the pitcher to Sweeney, who shook his head.
Had enough, thanks.
Dooley, I swan, that's 3 times you've rode in here and 3 times I've set it out for you. You ought to write it down or something. I mean, I might get killed before you ride through again.
Ain't dead yet, are you?
That's what you said last time.
Well, mayhaps that's why you're still kicking, Bob. Ever think of that?
Sweeney had listened to everything Buckshot Bob had told Monahan for 3 nights, and he had to admit that the old cowboy had surely had one hell of a tangled life. He'd sure been banged up a lot, too. Been thumped upside the head more often than Daisy June had fleas. Any other fellow would have been dead, but not Monahan. It had scrambled his brain a little, but he was still around. Now that was the sign of one tough customer. Of course, the story Bob had told didn't really match up. More like the story was broken into 3 segments. One long stretch of time and 2 short ones. The long one lasted from Dooley's time with Monty's Raiders back to, well, Iowa in his childhood. The next one, shorter than the first, was about Kathleen and his wild times in the South. And the third was later still, up around the end of the Civil War. Sweeney imagined Monahan's whole life as a great big hunk of Swiss cheese, all full of holes, filled with nothing but mystery, and none of them connected. Not as far as he could figure, anyhow. If he'd had access to paper and pen, he would have tried to chart it out, to figure the big empty places still remaining and the ones that had been filled in by Bob. He figured there were big, deep holes that would surprise the pudding out of Monahan himself. Things buried so deep that not only did Dooley forget them, he'd also forgotten that he forgot them. Sweeney hadn't had a chance to talk to Dooley about it in private because Bob and May had put him up in Robbie's room like he was some kind of kid, and Monahan was sleeping in the barn by his own choice. He hadn't had a chance to talk to Julia either. She was bunking in with Maggie, and the girls were having a high time of it, whispering and giggling and doing all kinds of, well, girl stuff. He had no time for any of it, and they in turn had no time for him whatsoever. Even the blue dog wasn't giving him the time of day, preferring to follow Hoskins' dog, Daisy June, around like she was the beginning and end all of the world. Only his horse, Chili, seemed to have the slightest interest in him, and that was only around feeding time. But nothing could disinterest him in the story he'd been hearing out on the front porch, and nothing could keep him from siding Monahan, not even the threat of the Baylor boys, who might be coming from the north at any minute. Not even the story about Man-Eater Monahan and the business with the alligator. Sweeney had latched on to the old cowboy for good or ill, and once he got his boots slid into the stirrups of a situation, he stayed around for the whole ride.
Moon's nice tonight.
The elf stood about 10 feet out from the campfire, staring upward. His brother sat about the same distance from him, shaking his head. Since they'd ridden out of Iron City, Alf had carried on about the moon or the grass or the trees or the cactus. Not once had he so much as noticed that Dev had broken him out of jail. Again.
I ain't sure we're going the right way.
Then just where do you think we ought to be going?
North.
Why north?
The moon told me.
Well, that's a new one.
Clouds had talked to Alf before. Also trees, sagebrush, the occasional saguaro cactus, titmice, badgers, pronghorn, even the wind. They all talked to Alf at one time or another, but never the moon.
Why is the moon talking to you all of a sudden? I mean, why ain't it talking to the president or some king or queen or somebody?
I don't know. Mayhap they ain't awake. We got any biscuits left?
Pan by the fire.
Alf helped himself. He popped one in his mouth, whole.
Hey, coffee?
By the fire.
Alf poured himself a cup, and Dev, hidden by shadows, shook his head again, thinking they'd been dead wrong to bust Alf out of that asylum. At least he hadn't sleep-talked any of that crazy English stuff, roos and wallabies, whatever they were, while they were on the trail. Seemed to Dev Alf was always trying to get himself killed, or worse, get Dev killed. One day he was bound to succeed. Dev considered Alf's recommended direction. North was exactly where he figured Dooley Monahan wasn't headed, but he decided to keep it to himself for a bit.
I'll keep that in mind, Alf. I mean, what the moon has to say about going north. But I just want to keep on heading west for another day or so, just to make sure.
All right. Just to make sure.
The next afternoon, Monahan, Sweeney, Julia, and Blue were on the road again, traveling west, backtracking over the Mormon Trail, despite Bob and May asking if they could stay longer, which might have given Julia the chance to learn what a real family was like, and maybe even get some schooling. They set out at 6 a.m. May had stuffed a gunny sack full of food for the trail.
Can we stop and have lunch now?
If we're voting, put me down on her side. I am hungry.
That stuff May packed for us looks too good to put off eating any longer.
All right, all right.
Monahan reined General Grant over to one side of the trail near a small spring. Julia and Butch reined in and dismounted as well. Julia held out the sack wide open.
Which do you want? We've got ham, fried chicken, and boiled eggs, and bread to make sandwiches.
Fried chicken, if you please.
Best water the horses first, boy. That dog's bound to be thirsty, too.
Right.
A short time later, Sweeney returned with the water, and Julia made sandwiches for everyone. They sat together in a small circle.
I got something I want to say to the both of you.
So, start from the beginning, Dooley.
All right. The reason we left first thing this morning was that I was afraid if we didn't, the reason for leaving would get lost in the shuffle.
I'm lost right now.
I don't blame you, Missy. But let me say out more of it, and mayhap you can put the pieces together better than me. I'm a little confuddled on the details.
She narrowed her brows but stayed quiet.
Reckon Butch has already told you about Buckshot Bob being my living memory for a few years of my life.
She nodded.
Well, I want you to keep on telling, and you should go back there every so often and keep listening. Because if anything should happen, old Buckshot Bob, you'll be the ones I'm looking up every decade or so to help me recollect. Got that?
Yes, sir.
He looked toward Sweeney. The young cowboy looked up from his sandwich.
Got it.
Monahan nodded and took another bite of chicken. It was dang tasty.
All right. Well, now we got that settled. During all those days I was talking to Buckshot Bob, he mentioned a little place called Heber's Kiss. Anyhow, don't nothing much go on out there. But according to old Bob, the old man who owned the saloon passed on. It was natural-like, no bullets or Apaches involved, but before he went, he gave over his share in the Lucky Strike Bar to a feller just passing through town. His name was Vince George. And I recalled that I knowed Vince George from way back. He was riding with Monty's Raiders when I joined up. He was the first one who beat my brains into a pulp. I owe him.
Julia and Sweeney stopped eating and were just staring at each other. He looked more than a little perturbed, and she appeared confused.
What?
Is that why you brought her along? To help you get revenge? When she could have stayed back at Buckshot Bob's and got the benefit of some book learning?
You want to be the one to take her back?
I don't care whether he wants to or not. I'm staying with you and Blue, so there. I feel like I gotta get my revenge on somebody, and it don't matter much who. This Vince George is as good a target as any.
Sweeney's mouth hung open at her clipped words. She looked at him.
And don't you go questioning Dooley Monahan. This is his trip, and I'm along for the ride just like you are.
Sweeney closed his mouth.
So, how you gonna recognize him after all these years, Dooley? By my reckoning, it's been 20 or so years since you seen him.
Oh, I'll know him. You will, too. He's got a long scar upside his face.
Monahan drew an imaginary line with his finger from his cheek up through his eye, through his eyebrow, and past his hairline.
He got cut bad in a knife fight, and once you seen it, you won't forget it. He got a way about him, too. Acts like a scofflaw.
Never met a feller who didn't act like one.
Well, you met me. I ain't no outlaw.
I said acts like, not that you were one.
All right, children, enough.
Don't go calling me that. Just because I'm younger than you don't mean I'm some child.
Hell, everybody's younger than you.
Boy, howdy, Butch. You surely got some bark on you.
That night they found a small area where Monahan felt it was safe to lead the horses off the roadways, and they made camp. Sweeney told Julia the story of Monahan's life. He was up to the part with the alligator, and she listened while making supper. It was a makeshift stew with chunks of leftover ham and chicken and vegetables May had included in the bag. As for Monahan, he lay on his bedroll, hands clasped behind his head, drifting in and out of sleep. He thought he was too excited about his impending meeting with Vince George to relax, but found excitement had been replaced by a calm inner surety. Things were finally going the way they were supposed to. He was finally feeling justified. Whether it was right or not, it was justified by God. 3 days away from Monahan's position, the Baylor boys had stopped for the night, too. Dev washed his dirty dishes in the nearby creek and was setting a coffee pot on a flat rock near the fire when Alf suddenly exploded.
No! No! Damn it!
Dev glanced over. Alf sat across from him, his right hand cradling his left.
Hurt yourself there, Alf?
Damn knife. Playing mumble peg.
Let me see your hand.
No!
Fine. If you don't care if you get blood poison, I guess I don't care neither.
Alf had been asking to get knocked upside the head for the last 3 nights. He'd been talking in his sleep, and two of those nights he'd waken Dev in the middle of the night with tirades on everything from the lousy job the blacksmith three towns back had done to why he was certain if a man got on a boat in California and sailed straight west, he'd land in London, to how cheddar cheese came to be yellow when it was made from white milk, just like Swiss cheese. Something to do with the sweat of mice was his answer, to which Dev could think of absolutely nothing in the way of a counter. As he watched his brother cradling his hand, Dev hoped Alf had finally done something with fatal consequences to himself. If only so, he'd shut the hell up.
Dev, would you look at it now?
Give it here.
Alf did, and Dev turned it over, searching through the grime. He found one small wound which looked to have been caused by a too close association with the dull edge of Alf's pocket knife. He let go of the hand.
You'll live.
Ain't gonna get poison blood?
No. Did you clean them squirrels you shot this afternoon?
No. Sorry.
Well, sorry don't get us fed. Best get them cleaned and do it now.
I was sorry because I ain't got them.
What did you do? Lose them along the trail someplace? You beat everything, you know that, Alphonse? What do you propose we have for dinner now?
Alf looked down and shrugged. Dev knew he was suitably cowed. Best to call a halt before he got his back up.
All right, I reckon I can just make extra biscuits.
We got enough honey?
Dev shook his head. Later, while Alf was scraping at the bottom of the honey jar, Dev checked his laundry drying on the nearby bushes.
Come morning, we're going south.
Why come?
Thought you'd be happy. You're the one who wanted so bad to stop going west.
No, I wanted to go north, not south.
So you did. But I don't think Monahan went that way. My money's on the south. Maybe the south of Arizona, not California.
Aw, damn. That's a whole lot of territory we gotta backtrack.
Not the way I got it figured. You just calm yourself, Alf. Let me take care of it.
The truth was, he wasn't certain where to head. But he knew it wasn't to the north, and it sure wasn't toward the west. At least not any farther than they'd already traveled. He figured Dooley Monahan was close by, holed up in some little smidge of a town where there were hardly any people. That fits southern Arizona the best. Well, about all of Arizona, if you wanted to get right down to it. But since they were closer to the southern part, he was sticking to his story. Besides, he'd like to get the killing of Monahan over and done with while he still had clean clothes.
Are you sure?
Sure as anything. Now go ahead and eat the last biscuit, Alf. I ain't hungry anymore.
Well, thanks, Dev.
Morning found Monahan, Sweeney, and Julia still on the old Mormon trail, slowly taking them west toward California. Monahan mused as he rode. He hoped the kids would keep repeating his life story, or at least the chunk Buckshot Bob had held for him. It was real exciting once he'd separated himself from it and made it seem like someone else's life. Once they got to the Colorado River, Monahan had it in his mind they'd turn south and follow its banks past Yuma to where Heber's Kiss was supposed to be. He'd never been there, but he'd heard a few hands speak of it over the years. It was supposed to be a pretty dismal place, all told, with a combination store-saloon, practically no populace, and no law to speak of. Just the sort of place Vince George would end up leading him to. Some no-account sun-bleached corner of hell. But it was just as well that the outlaw hadn't chosen a more populated spot, with more possibilities for witnesses. Fighting it out to the end might as well happen in Heber's Kiss, where there would be fewer people to laugh at Monahan if he failed, and no one to lock him up if he ever came out the winner, especially since he didn't plan to give the other man a fair chance. No fairer than he'd already received at Vince George's hands, anyway. He had Sweeney and the dog, but didn't suppose the two of them together could make up for a sidekick chosen from any one of Monty's raiders, especially Red Usher. As he plodded along, Monahan could hear the outlaw's laugh and remembered the rifle butt cracking his skull for the third time. It was a highly unpleasant sound, that laugh, forever after associated with crippling pain. And it marked the beginning of Monahan's unraveling patchwork of a life. The hardest blows had been dealt by Vince, and they had sent the young Dooley tumbling down the lifelong maze he had come to know and forget and remember and forget again as his existence on Earth. A life with no past, no future, only a present. A life without a woman or children or grandchildren. A life without stability, without a place to call home, with no history, good or ill, and a life forever on the scout. That, he realized for the first time, was what those idiot boys had clubbed him toward and what they had made him into. He was going to have his vengeance, by God. He was going to make Vince sorry he'd ever heard of Dooley Monahan. It made him smile to think about it.
Hold up here. Horses need water, and so do I. I want to set on something that ain't moving for a while.
He sat down in the center of that wide, rutted excuse for a road and had himself a long drink of water from his canteen. Julia sat down in the middle of the road, too, but she wasn't sure what was going on. She wondered what on earth Monahan was smiling about. She shot Sweeney a questioning look, but his only response was to wiggle his eyebrows at her. She decided she would never, as long as she lived, understand the male of the species. If she asked a boy under the age of 12 a question, he'd say something mean or hit her and run away. Anyone over that age would pretend she was joking, or he was joking, or somebody somewhere was joking. Mostly, she figured to never expect a straight answer at all. Sweeney had watered his horse and was sitting with Monahan and Julia, but kept quiet, not paying much attention to either. He was getting tired of being Monahan's toady, tired of doing everything Monahan's way. He had wanted to ride with the famous Dooley Monahan because he thought the old cowboy would have some magical information to share, some sort of mystique that would rub off on him. So far, the only thing that had rubbed off was dog hair. Well, there was the Vince George character to consider. Of course, he dated from way back in Dooley's life. He was likely a half-dead old cripple plagued by rheumatism, arthritis, a lifelong case of worms, and the scabies, and those dementia trembler things from years of living inside a whiskey bottle. The longer Sweeney thought on it, the worse candidate for a gunfight Vince George became. In fact, it didn't take long for him to reduce the outlaw to an incoherent, pustule-covered, moronic invalid who no longer knew which end of a gun the bullet came out of. But then again, Sweeney shook his head.
Don't think about that. Thinking only brings trouble.
A glance at Monahan showed he was ready to mount up. So was Julia. Yeah. As he got to his feet, Sweeney decided not to say anything. Not yet. He'd ride to Heber's Kiss and take a look at this Vince George fella. And when he turned out to be a silly old man and nothing more than a monster under the bed built solely from Monahan's faulty memory, Sweeney would tip his hat, say goodbye, and go on alone. Without comment, Monahan tightened his horse's girth strap. The road ahead looked just like the road behind, deserted and desolate, a land only the devil could love. 2 days later, they reached the Colorado River and turned south, following along its eastern bank. They stopped a few hours in Yuma, which wasn't long enough for Sweeney, but far too long a stay for Monahan, considering the territorial prison was there. Julia seemed happy to take in the sights, such as they were, and to find a store that sold lemon drops. She bought a huge bag of them. It filled up half of one of her saddlebags, and spent the whole of that day sucking away at the candy. As they left town, she offered them to Monahan and Sweeney. The young cowboy took her up on it and helped himself to a handful. The old man turned her down, though he pointed out that Blue might like one just for the sugar in it. And danged if she didn't unwrap one and toss it to him. He crunched it up then and there, swallowed it down, and begged her for another. Monahan had never heard of a dog liking lemons, not fresh ones, or lemonade, or lemon candy, or even lemon pie. And it sorely confused him. Since confusion was a state of mind that was nothing new for him, neither of his companions paid it much heed. He'd been teasing Julia about the candy, but maybe he'd been right without knowing it. Maybe dogs did like lemons. That would sure be a new one, him being right. It must be by accident. Lately, he couldn't have been correct on purpose for love nor money. and frankly, his old head was too full of Heber's Kiss and Vince George to dwell on much of anything else. He wondered how the years had treated Vince. Badly, he hoped. It'd be a lot easier for him to kill a man who only had one arm or one leg. He only knew he'd never hoped for anybody to be blind in both eyes with such committed vigor. They made camp along the banks of the river before the sun set. They hadn't seen a soul since they left Yuma, although Julia had seen something in the distance that might have been a building. It was hard to tell, but with the desert heat playing games with their eyes and all. But still, she had heeded Monahan's warnings.
Watch for Apache signs. Keep your eyes and ears open, both of you.
Julia reached over and put her hand on Blue's back. He was stretched out, flat as a frog, between her and Monahan in the gloom. He turned his head toward her and threw her his old blue dog smile. At least she was pretty certain it was a smile. She was convinced that if Blue could laugh, he'd be laughing to beat the band all day long. That was what kind of traveling companion he was. He was a sight better than the two men of late. Monahan had been pretty much silent for the whole day. He hadn't flinched when they rode past the prison in Yuma, although he'd kept his head low. And he hadn't argued with her when she asked to stop for candy. Actually, it was kind of a shame he hadn't, because she'd had her reasons already figured out in her head and ready for spewing why she should be allowed to do anything she dang well pleased. Practically the only thing he'd said all day was to warn them about Apaches. She hadn't seen one sign of them. It sort of ruined a person's faith in the beware the heathen horde fantasy. She decided she'd never believe another dime novel again. Why, for the whole time she'd been in the Arizona Territory, she'd never seen an Indian of any sort. Not an Apache, not a Yuma, not a Navajo, not any of them. Well, except maybe for that boy with the dime novel name who worked at the Iron Creek Livery. Monahan tapped her on the arm.
Biscuits?
He was putting clumps of dough into a skillet for baking. She nodded enthusiastically. Although May's food had been good, Julia enjoyed Dooley's food just as much, if the truth be told, and his sourdough biscuits best of all. Next to her, he set the lid on the biscuit skillet, then pulled out a large pot and began pulling the last of the remaining vegetables from May's sack of victuals.
Stew?
Yeah.
What kind?
Vegetable. Unless you got some desert quail or pork chops hid in your saddlebags.
Pray not.
Didn't think so.
Don't you want to have a conversation?
He gave her a funny look, like she was crazy.
No, never mind.
Turning away from him, she put her arm around Blue.
Won't they talk to you neither?
In reply, he slung his muzzle toward her and licked her across the nose.
Guess that means yes.
What are you two talking about?
We were just saying how you and Butch are keeping your own company of late and got no time for girls or dogs.
That's not true, is it, Butch?
Huh?
Well, maybe it is.
Maybe what is, Dooley?
Sorry, boy, it was nothing.
She followed Monahan's gaze off into the distance.
What do you see out there? Apaches?
Nope. Nothing like.
Then what?
Nothing at all. Just an old man's past, looking towards his future.
What?
Honey, my head's so fuzzy and disjointed. If you're smart, you won't listen to a dang thing I say.
Okay.
Julia rested her head in her hands. Maybe he was right. Maybe he was all fuzz-brained. Maybe they'd finally get down to Heber's Kiss and that Vince feller would kill him and that would be the end of it. But that made her sad. About as sad as anything she could think of. The old cowboy had saved her from the desert and then from her previous so-called caretaker. And she figured she kind of owed him. Beside her, Monahan continued staring blankly out over the desert. There was nothing to see but distant hills picking up the last weak rays of the setting sun and the first feeble rays of the crescent moon just beginning to rise. He wondered about old Vince, about Heber's Kiss. Monahan shook his head. He didn't know the name Heber, except from an inscription in a copy of the Book of Mormon somebody had thrust on him in prison. That was a part of his life he'd like to forget, permanently. But he couldn't think why anyone would name a whole town after the man, or his kiss in particular. Danged if he could even remember if Heber had kissed anybody. Not far from where Monahan and his companions sat near their pot of simmering stew, Vincent George sat alone in the main room of his new bar. Well, new to him, anyway. There were no customers. There were never any customers. Heber's kiss was an Arizona town with two boots dangling over the edge of a grave. Sean Jacoby, former owner of Jacoby's Saloon, had sworn to him the saloon was a cash cow. When Vince pointed out he hadn't seen a customer since he rode into town the day before, Jacoby had insisted the Owl Hoot had just come on an off day. Customers were thick as thieves in Heber's Kiss, Jacoby swore. Folks in dire need of drink rode in day and night. The only place of business that could supply their demand and quench their thirst was his saloon. Well, Vince had taken his word like a blatant idiot, and he'd been sitting there day and night since Jacoby died, but he hadn't seen one lousy soul, thirsty or otherwise. It was as if the whole town had sworn off liquor or something. He wished he'd plugged Jacoby instead of letting him die naturally. For sure, he wished he hadn't witnessed that paper for him, which had been Jacoby's will, such as it was, naming Vince the sole beneficiary. Of course, there was no lawyer in town to untangle the mess. Not that Vince had ever had much faith in the law. The whole deal confused him so badly, he'd hung around for a while trying to get it straight in his head and to see if anybody showed up. Nobody had. Heber's Kiss was the kiss of death for a saloon keeper. And so Vince George had decided to take his leave of Heber's Kiss, Arizona Territory in general, and Jacoby's Saloon in particular. He'd spent one day rummaging through Jacoby's victuals and another trying to scare up some game. Jacoby had owned a donkey or a burro or something, and he'd figured to take that along, too. He might get $10 for it in a town like Tucson if he ended up going that way. On the other hand, he could always turn it loose, or butcher it if worst came to worst. George poured himself a drink. That was one thing there wasn't a shortage of, liquor. For a man who'd claimed to be doing such a stellar business, old Jacoby certainly had a monstrous backlog of stock. There were cases of it, and not just the bad stuff, either. At that moment, Vince decided he was riding out in the morning and definitely taking the mule, if only to haul its weight in booze. He poured out another drink, thinking of the man-high piles of cases in the back room, and tossed it back. Julia and Sweeney had finally gone to sleep, but Monahan sat up and smoked for a time, thinking his next actions would shape the whole of his future. Surely he had come to similar junctures before, but he couldn't remember them. The 10 years Buckshot Bob Hoskins had kept for him were already slipping away. He could feel the tides that ebbed and flowed in his mind, sweeping them from the trembling sands of his memory. He had known Bob from prison, that was it. But which one? And why had he been in prison anyway? Damned if he could remember. Monahan concentrated on prison. He managed to dredge up a tiny snatch of a mental picture. Other men were there. Live men, dead men, sick men, injured men. Injured men. Was it wartime? He concentrated harder on the mental picture, trying to see his sleeves to find a trace of a uniform, blue or gray, but he couldn't find one. He could see only muddy rags, like those worn by the few men standing in the murky, misty background. Stretching out, he decided to join Sweeney and Julia in comfortable slumber. He lay down in his spot beside the fire with the nagging half-memory of those poor men in the mist, swathed in rags, and so very lost.